We kick off tonight with a conversation that has been gathering momentum for years now, but real momentum ever since what has become known as 9/12 growth. And we need growth above all else if we ensure the ongoing political, social and economic stability of the country. This was the key message among some many interesting messages to emerge from the Centre for Development and Enterprise's series of reports. They're entitled The Growth Agenda, and they were launched amid a great media fanfare at Constitution Hill recently. It's a great pleasure to welcome the CDE's Executive Director, Anne Bernstein. Anne, welcome.
Thanks, Michael. Good to be here.
Also on the line, I have Kevin Lings, Chief Economist at Stanlib, whom I haven't spoken with in a while. Kevin, thanks for joining us.
Only a pleasure.
And Zico Capital MD, Tseko Sefolo. Tseko, likewise, great to chat to you again.
Thanks for having me, Michael, and good evening to your listeners.
Now, Anne, having read through, and I'll be perfectly honest here, I've read through your 30-page growth document, but I haven't read through all seven separate documents, but it really is, it's quite telling, isn't it? And I was at a breakfast with Jabu Mabuza recently. He made the excellent point that you can have periods of jobless growth, and I think he was referring quite correctly to our sticky unemployment levels, but you can't have growthless job creation, can you?
Well, not really. High growth rates are absolutely essential for South Africa to deal with our terrible unemployment challenge. I mean, we're not just a little bit, we're a country with an unemployment rate that is a global outlier. So we have structural unemployment, which we have to deal with, and that requires high growth, but very importantly, job-rich growth, much more labor-intensive growth than we've had in the past.
And Kevin, if we were to look at the reasons behind this jobless growth, much of it also has at its root, reading through the CDE's analysis, of this quest for what we like to call decent work. So almost work at a level that precludes us from competing at the lower end.
Yeah, I think that's to some extent fair. We have focused on that within some areas of the debate, that it's not just about jobs, but we want so-called decent jobs. From our perspective, obviously, we need to create as many jobs as possible at every level of income and skill, etc. And I think that if our focus on decent jobs means that we don't focus enough on employment, then that's not ideal. I think that the unemployment rate that South Africa is dealing with is so substantial that we desperately need to get people into employment at any level. What we do know from the data produced by Stats SA is that once somebody has gained job experience, work experience, their ability to retain that job and their ability to progress is much, much better. The difficulty in South Africa, to me, stands out in the data, is getting the person their first job opportunity. And if we are too pedantic about that our job opportunity must be, then potentially we're stifling the development of the labor market. So I would just be cautious around that. To me, I would focus on getting people their first job, particularly youth, getting them some experience, and then trying to progress from there.
Tseko, in order to do that, though, we'd have to seriously reform some of our onerous labor laws. Do you think that this is politically possible in this environment? Do you think we've reached that inflection point where we can sit down and have a really rational and mature and level-headed conversation about the fact that we need to be expanding opportunities, that first step on the ladder, as opposed to the mantra around decent work?
Well, that is indeed the challenge, yeah. But I think that we cannot have and afford the luxury not to do it. You know, when you're talking about a scenario where you've got in excess of 50% unemployment rate amongst the youth, then you suddenly realize that the politicking needs to stop, and we need to do, you know, some fundamental things to make sure that we get these people into the mainstream economy. Because if we don't do that, unfortunately, we create problems which in the long term will be very difficult for us to unravel. You know, when you look at issues like the Arab Spring, for example, and you look at where those emanated from, it's these sort of scenarios that over time they're allowed to perpetuate. And unfortunately, if, you know, if they're left to go unattended, at a point in time, it just becomes very difficult. So, you know, our labor laws were done, obviously, at a point in time. there were certain issues that we needed to be sensitive to at that point in time. But, you know, if you go back to, for example, 2013, and you calculate, you know, the number of working days that were lost, particularly in the mining sector, as a result of strikes, you know, the numbers are astounding. And you have to ask yourself, what is the impact of that on, you know, our ability to employ? And then you'll probably find that, you know, without proper, you know, addressing of these issues, I think we're just creating a challenge for ourselves going forward.
And we have this wonderful opportunity that you articulate, Anne, in the report. The fact that China is said to be exporting approximately 85 million jobs in the next decade. And it's a staggering figure that if we could relocate just you know, a percentage of those jobs here, we would see a hugely demonstrable impact. But we can't currently because of this this focus, firstly, on decent work, but secondly, on the way our policies are targeting, you know, our value in the manufacturing system at a higher level than perhaps we can deliver according to our skills.
Well, that's the key point we're trying to get across, that South Africa has to say to itself, and the policymakers have to acknowledge that what we've been doing hasn't been working. So even when we growing at a high rate, which we did in the 2000s for a few years, most of the jobs we were creating, and we did create new jobs, were for skilled people and semi-skilled people. So the location of manufacturing is changing worldwide, and those are the jobs that are leaving China, the most basic kinds of manufacturing. And that's really what we're saying. South Africa should take advantage of this, and we should try and get some. Ethiopia's done it. And from, you know, one of the poorest countries in the world, they now have a very small but growing export shoe industry. Imagine what we could do. And we're suggesting that Nelson Mandela Bay would be an ideal location for an export processing zone geared at pretty low-level manufacturing. You don't just have one underutilized port. You have two underutilized ports. And we think it's really possible for South Africa to make bid for some of these jobs. Who knows if this 86 million is the right number, but even if it's less, we just need a fraction of those jobs to change lots and lots of people's lives and get them into an entry-level job.
And I mean, the arguments that you articulate for an export processing zone for the Nelson Mandela Bay Metro are quite compelling, because even if you fail, I mean, the costs of establishing such a zone are minuscule in comparison with the chances of success. But just talk to me about some of the key advantages of an export processing zone model as opposed to an SEZ, which we've tried in the past.
Well, look, you can call these zones whatever you want. So South Africa had industrial development zones in the past, which even the government has now acknowledged failed. And we're saying there's some key issues that need to be dealt with if we have a chance of success, because most of these zones fail in many countries all over the world. But if you look at the success stories, special is important. They have to be special compared to the rest of the economy. And we're saying, let's try this out in one part of our economy. Open a window for this kind of low-skill manufacturing to help South Africa get away from the high-growth, high-skill, high-wage, high-skill approach that has been government policy for so long.
And key to that, Kevin, is also the fact that you would have to, if you operated in this export processing zone, export 100% of what you manufacture. So it's not like you're going to be operating on an unlevel playing field and then producing back into the South African market.
That's right. You generally set them up with a strong export bias. When you look around the world, it's not as if all these zones have 100% export. Some of them have a small amount that goes into the domestic economy. But in order to qualify all these for the benefits or the advantages or the incentives that go along with this, then obviously you've got to demonstrate that you have an export capacity. You've just got to be a little bit careful with these zones, because in terms of the World Trade Organization, you can't purposely subsidize exports through tax incentive. So you would have to make sure that it's that you're compliant with World Trade Organization. The idea of setting up a specific area that that is focused on trying to export close to port, close to good infrastructure, I think is worth the effort of trying. And it's something that has been talked about literally in South Africa probably for the last 20, 30 years, actually. But we've never really embraced it or tried it. And I think there are many initiatives that we should be simply trying to see whether they can't work. We're at that point where I don't know that we can really pick and choose.
Yeah, we're at that that spaghetti inflection point where we just need to fling it all at the wall and see what seems to work. And Seko, I think one of the other major concerns we have at the moment, and it was also mentioned in the report, is this worry about the deteriorating state of governance, especially in our state-owned enterprises. And I've heard behind the scenes that government and business have been working together on this one, and one of the suggestions to fix the problem is that the PIC might step in and convert much of its SOE debt into equity, and that has the twin advantage of bringing the PIC's expertise onto board level at these SOEs and also take much of the contingent risk off government's balance sheet. I mean, could you see that working?
Well, yeah, I suppose as an intervention and as a start. But having said that, you know, PIC converting its funding instrument into equity on its own is obviously not going to solve the problem. I think, you know, in the long term, we need to capacitate our state-owned entities to be able to do, you know, what they're supposed to be doing. So I look at Eskom, for example, and I say, well, what role does Eskom play in our ability to create jobs? And really, you know, boils down to fixed capital formation. Because as business, we take our lead from government. You know, when the environment is suitable for us to invest, then, you know, when we've got issues around, for example, the power crisis resolves, then, you know, it makes it easier for us to come in and be in a position to invest. Mm-hmm. So I think capacitating and making sure that state-owned enterprises have got the right people doing the right thing, and more importantly, there's less political meddling. Or, you know, you hear these things that people talk about around political intervention, state capture. You know, these are buzzwords that are going around. And unfortunately, these things are very toxic. They're very toxic for the economy that we currently operate in. Because you want, you know, your ESCOMs and your Transnets and your process of this world really doing what they're supposed to be doing on a daily basis.
And to feed into that, Anne, we need what you call a smart state with a far more pro-market stance, very similar, I guess, to the NDP capable state, perhaps going even slightly further than that, to beyond capable, to actually being a smart state. And once again, underpinning all that is this lack of trust between the private sector and the public sector. How much do you feel that the momentum generated by 9/12 is the catalyst to repair a lot of that broken trust?
Well, let me clarify our view on the state. We do want a capable state. We agree with NDP. We need a professional state, but we're saying it needs to be merit-based. So merit-based appointments, not jobs for cronies. And we're also saying that you need to open up the SOEs. You need to, it's not just the capital, which is vitally important, but you have to, you know, this is a country that talks a lot about the Competition Commission and having a more competitive economy. We're absolutely behind that. We want it for the whole economy. So we can't have monopolies in certain parts of our economy. We need to liberalize and deregulate markets, and we need competent people running enterprises and state departments, because this really has a very big impact on small business in South Africa. And we talked too much in many ways about big business and too little about small business and sort of new firms, which is exactly what South Africa needs. If we're going to truly transform our economy, we need lots and lots of new entrepreneurs who are getting opportunities to come in, but then we need a fully competitive economy across the board.
Kevin, and I think Anne just led with the chin a little bit there, so I'm going to say it is a two-way street here. How must business also get its house in order here? We hear a lot about opening up supply chains and using procurement, and ESD is the big buzzword. It's been allocated sort of 40 points in the revised codes. I mean, that's another issue altogether, whether or not transformation as it's currently articulated is anathema to growth. How do you see business playing its role and so in getting its house in order?
Yeah, I think business also needs to go through its own reform process. I don't think it's simply looking at government policy and saying that we need more clarity and more reform, etc. I think from a business perspective, we could certainly have a lot more entrepreneurial type initiatives. I think over time business has become too complacent in business as usual. I don't know that there's enough of an entrepreneurial spirit within business. And I think that partly links to how we remunerate executives. In other words, mm-hmm. executives get paid, I think, exceptionally well by South African standards. And is that pay commensurate with entrepreneurial activity, risk-taking, growing the business? Or is it pay that is a matter of business as usual? And I think that link needs to be more firmly established. And then obviously business to varying degrees at the moment recognizes the need for transformation, but you can clearly criticize along the way as to how that's been applied and recognizing what the overall economic environment and social environment in which business operates. And I think some businesses are very good at that and others less so. So I do think that business can play a more active role, a more transparent role. Although I would suggest that I think South African business on the whole would respond incredibly well to a more open, transparent policy approach from government. In other words, I think government would be surprised at how well business takes that up and is willing to invest on the back of that if there was more policy clarity, more engagement with business sector.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's quite clear that there is no functional business in a dysfunctional society, and I think any business anywhere in the world will understand that, and therefore this imperative to transform, to bring the 20 million left behind into the mainstream is something I think we can all agree upon. Well, what do you make of the transformation, elephant in the room almost?
Well, I keep moving from issues I want to comment on.
Everything.
I do want to talk about business, and the you know, you're saying, well, they would respond well to a different set of policies from government. Of course they would. I'm sure they would. But they also have to contribute more and participate in the public debate about what policies South Africa needs. So policies don't come out, you know, they're not laid down in heaven. They come out of a political environment in which the hurly-burly of debate takes place. And what I think South African business has been struggling with in a complex public environment is how to participate in the public discussion about how South Africa grows and how we get employment and how we change this economy so that everyone can participate.
Town square.
Issues here that need to be dealt with, and I think that this recognition that we can't go on the way with we are, whether in business or in government, but dominantly government has to change, but business has to play a part in that set of tough debates, both publicly and privately, on what needs to change, so as not to benefit just big business, but what will change, what needs to change so that everybody can benefit.
And as much as I want to continue on and get into some detail examples of, for example, the mining charter, which was published without extensive consultation, while we have business on the other side saying, well, consult us more, we want to be involved. I mean, it's exasperating sometimes just to see the two talking past each other. But unfortunately, we've reached the end of our time. It does mean we're going to have to return to this at a later stage, because this conversation isn't going anywhere. This debate, as you say, Anne, isn't going anywhere. and we'd like to provide that sort of town square space for us to fully articulate what it means to get the economy stuck in first gear into high growth. Thanks to all my guests tonight, the CDE's Executive Director Anne Bernstein, Kevin Lings, Chief Economist at Stanlib, and Zico Capital MD Tseho Sefolo. Tomorrow night, we're going to have a look at the rise of exchange-traded funds in a stock picker's market, which is quite interesting. For me, Michael, producer Amor Klakla, and sound engineer Mdu Tlele, thanks so much for tuning in to this opening wealth panel on Classic Business, brought to you as always by Old Mutual Wealth. Good night.
Where would we be without the power of great TV? Has your boss ever said, "I need that in the morning," just as you were about to pack up and join the boys to watch the rugby game live in HD? At the water cooler, ever asked yourself, "Who's that?" Because, well, you didn't see the latest episode, Express, from the US this morning? If you've said yes, any of the above, then say no. I want the power of great TV. Get DStv Premium. Get yourself the power of great TV with world-class sports, latest series, movies, and more. Best viewed on the Explorer. DStv Premium. Know best.
Classic FM 102.7. Classic Silver Screen with Glenn Lewington on Classic FM 102.7. Good evening. I hope you had a great weekend and a warm welcome to Classic Silver Screen on this Monday, the 18th of April. The music we start off with this evening is Joe Hisaishi's music to the 1984 Japanese animated film dealing with environmental issues, among others deforestation, and it was called Nausicaa of the Valley of the Wind.